Okay, folk, we'll make a start, if that's okay. Sharon is having a day off, so I have no person introducing me, but I think most of the faces are reasonably familiar. Is there anyone here that hasn't been to any of the seminars I've done this week? Okay, just one person, okay, don't worry. So, well, look, my name is it's Gary Mason. I'm a Methodist clergy person based in Belfast. Spearheading a non-profit at present called Rethinking Conflict. Most of my work is around conflict transformation, peace building and reconciliation. But for 28 years prior to that, I spearheaded a number of church-based initiatives in the inner city of Belfast. So today I want to do a kind of complete change of topic and just play about a little with this whole concept of how do we redirect the church outwards. So let me just depress you Americans for a moment and say this. The United States doesn't always come first. Okay. Now for us Europeans, invariably in the Olympics, we know that you Americans normally get the most gold medals. So that's or thereabouts. But UNICEF in recent years surveyed 21 of the most developed nations, and they measured how kids relate to other kids, how they spend time with their parents, how they use alcohol or drugs, and perceive their own happiness. Now, interestingly, tight-knit nations, and I know Dawn and I were having a conversation this morning about the Scandinavian nations, so like Sweden, Denmark, and Finland, the Netherlands as well, ranked the highest, interestingly, when it came to young people feeling secure and happy. I must say when I read that initially, it kind of jarred me somewhat because the sad thing is, and it's not unlike what you were saying last night, they're among the lowest church-going nations within the planet. So that's a kind of, I have to say that, it's a bit of a disturbing statistic.
Would you repeat those nations?
The Netherlands, Sweden, Denmark, and Finland.
And Norway.
Norway was not mentioned here, but I'm sure they're there. Okay. Maybe they were number five. Okay, yeah. I mean, another aside, which I haven't even written in this script, it's interesting that in sort of peace building, they put a tremendous amount of money into peace building. I know the Finnish government have funded one or two initiatives that I have been involved in. So it's kind of, it's a bit of enigma that almost. So the US finished almost at the bottom, wow. Next to last. Sadly, the UK was at the bottom of the list. So UNICEF's kind of opening thesis was this, that stable, supportive, family and social relationships are far more important to kids' well-being than how much expensive junk they have piled up in their rooms. Okay. So William Falk of The Week magazine, he editorialized something in these findings, and he said this. He said it would be comforting just to shrug off the report as anti-American bunkum. He says, but as a parent of a teen and a tween, I could not. He says, quite honestly, I have seen firsthand the emptiness that haunts so many middle-class kids. From an early age, they are taught that life is a pitiless pursuit of individual gratification and success, requiring above average brains and most certainly above average looks. There's no sense of context, community, or higher purpose. And he suggests it's hardly surprising then that so many of our teenagers are taking antidepressants, ADHD meds or other pills. He says many others hide their sadness in eating disorders. Drugs are meaningless hookups. So in our Rashi says to give our kids everything, I'm afraid we've forgotten to help them to answer a question that won't be ignored. What is all this for? What are we searching for? And in reality, Nadia and I sort of stole a quiet coffee there this morning and to kind of analyse the meaning of life in 1 hour. We didn't get it, but but we did come to the conclusion that our churches are basically quite selfish, narcissistic, and very inward-looking. One of my favourite books in the Bible, which maybe says something about my strange personality, which my wife tells me I have, is Ecclesiastes. I think really it is the book for us 21st century people who want to pursue happiness in whatever definition we find it. I remember speaking on that book at one stage in the Queen's University in a bar, so where people were swilling down pints. I was kind of unsure what I was going to speak on. Sometimes I do this, and Joyce says, "You mean you're getting up to speak and you haven't worked anything out?" And it was one of those kind of occasions, and I just realized just getting up and just reading a text wasn't going to work. Because you had all these people drinking cocktails, swilling beer, drinking spirits. And I got up and I said, I know this guy who had sex with 500 women and he said it wasn't worthwhile. So all the pints went down really quickly. People looked up and go, this sounds really interesting. So, and I said, isn't it strange that we've been told about our identity? The more people we sleep with, the more sex we have, the more we are going to be fulfilled. Now this person's name was Solomon, because he did have sex with at least 500 women. But in Ecclesiastes chapter 12, he sits on a hill outside Jerusalem, and he said, it wasn't worth it. I need to get back to God. So he pursues sexuality, he pursues architecture, he pursues wisdom, he pursues wealth. And us moderns almost assume in our arrogance at times that we are the first generation exploring all this stuff. Such nonsense. Solomon did it 3,500 years ago and said it really wasn't worthwhile. So I just want to suggest to you that I think the church in the West, particularly in the suburbs, have what I call a kind of fortress mentality. Invariably, we're indoors, listening to our own reassuring voices, and as a writer of another generation said, we are building million-dollar salt depositories on street corners, when in reality, we are meant to be salt dispensers. So play with that analogy. Is your church a salt depository or a salt dispenser? Because Jesus uses that analogy and he says very clearly, if you rub salt into the carcass of your putrefying society, it's going to change. And I know all of us, I'm guessing, who are involved in church, who are pastors and leaders, there is not a week goes past in my life where someone in a Christian framework doesn't say to me, you know, Gary, isn't the church and the world in an awful state? And I often say, well, I think primarily it's the church's fault. Let me tell you why. Jesus says, if you rub salt into the carcass of a putrefying society, it's going to change. So if the world is so chaotic and we are building salt depositories instead of salt dispensers, why is the world not changing? And interestingly, David Fitch, in his book called The Great Giveaway, in chapter 2, he puts forward his thesis. He says that the new post-enlightenment generations will not trust the highly produced worship, seeker-sensitive Sunday morning service of the mega church. He says, the new generation, listen to some of these phrases, because they are, I think, kind of holden phrases. He says, they trust community. They trust places to connect. And this next phrase, superb. They trust authentic, lived truth. The organic beauty of a simple worship liturgy. And he says postmoderns actually suspect the machinations of consumer-orientated messages that have power over them to make them buy decisions. He says postmoderns actually recognize truth for it is lived day to day with one another. The postmodern is convinced of truth through participation, not through consumer appeals, through holy lived display, not reasoned arguments. And he says, you know, seeker-sensitive services, as we call them, will still work for the boomers, those raised in modernity, either by age or in that evangelical subculture. So these people of modernity, he suggests, were taught to trust only their individual minds or experiences. He says, but postmoderns know their minds or experiences can be manipulated. So some of this next generation see marketing and advertising as nothing more than capitalistic intrusions with an agenda in deforming people certain ways so as to benefit certain economic power interests. And he says they respect truth that is lived. They're looking for a home, a community wherein a belonging can take root and the moral fabric of truth can be borne out. So if postmodern culture is for real, seeker-sensitive services are running out of time, he suggests. He says the next generation seeks community over feeling anonymous and is overdosed on consumer appeals to felt needs. Postmoderns desire something bigger to be transformed. And I think too much of the church in the West continues to separate the evangelical and social aspects of the gospel. I think one of the reasons we do this is because it results from a kind of basic individualism that doesn't see the broader relationships of the gospel. I think if we saw our mission as people-centered, we would focus that holistically. So a people-centered approach would bring Christ the people and will impact the whole Christ. So let me just try to tease some of this out a little here. The Bible and social action. So in Christ, the body, to use that language, gives visibility to Christ in the world, and each of us gives visibility to the whole body. So Peter calls us to serve in humility, to enable one another rather than to compete. So salvation is not thought of only as an assurance of forgiveness and a future life. It is to be seen as redemption that reconciles us to God, establishes a new community, and enables a new order of life. Now, all of us in this room know people cannot be dissected into parts. We are unitary beings. So consequently, I want to suggest, we cannot minister to the mind apart from the personality, nor to the soul apart from the body. So Christian faith shouldn't be following Greek dualism that separates the physical and the spiritual. So as in the Hebrew tradition, Christian faith should regard persons as unitary beings, each one integrated personality. So physical, emotional, spiritual, intellectual, and relational aspects of life are all part of one unitary being. So physical well-being is not unimportant, because when health is lacking, we can be left without other resources. So let me ask another question. How does the Bible, and there's a typo here, teach us to serve, not survive? Okay. So I want to suggest by identification with the needy. Someone during Jason's session this morning, who may well be here in this session as well, mentioned the parable of the Good Samaritan. And I've often asked the whole question in relation to that. The Good Samaritan is really a very underplayed story. I mean, Jesus was too good a master storyteller to be involved in exaggeration. I mean, the Good Samaritan is a nothingness story, really. I know every single person in this room, although I don't know you individually. If you saw a person by the wayside who was injured, you would be more than happy to put him into a lodgings for one or two nights and pay the bill. So the person who's the Good Samaritan does not commit their life to this person forever. They're not putting him to some form of semi-orthopedic care for a lifetime. So in that sense, I think sometimes the church in the West, and particularly the American church, is always looking for what I call luxurious solutions. The Good Samaritan is not a luxurious solution. It's a very simple solution. I mean, in this room, how many times have you lifted a person up? Have you given them a couple of $100 to see them on their way? That's all really the Good Samaritan did. It's nothing profound. It's not that earth-shattering. And that's why I think Jesus is such a brilliant master storyteller. He's not telling a parable that has lots of luxurious solutions. It's something every single person in this room can do today. And we talked about that the other day, not who is my neighbor? Jesus was asking the question in the context of the lawyer and the Good Samaritan, who is being a neighbor? So the question we normally ask when we hear this story is, who is my neighbor? Jesus turns it completely in his head and said, no, I want to ask you something different. I want to ask you the question, who is being a neighbor? So the question for us 21st century mortals is this, am I willing to be a neighbor to any person in need? So the challenge of the story is that love is not fulfilled by affirmations of the mind, but by actions of ministry. One seminary professor writing to some theologians who were training said this, beware of thinking that when you have read something, you have experienced it. Beware of thinking that when you have read something, you have experienced it. And I think he was really saying is that love is more than an attitude, although it is that. But love is an act, it's a step into community, it's a step into relationship. So keeping our sense of participation in the community of the King very front, very center, we keep our relationship to Christ clear and authentic. So I'm not referring to some sweet Jesus salvation, primarily internal and self-fulfilling, but the rigorous discipleship with the Jesus who asks us to take up the cross. So A.W. Tozer, the evangelical mystic who, as many of you know, pastored the People's Church in Toronto for so many years, said this, the cross will cut into our lives where it hurts, sparing neither us nor our carefully cultivated reputations. Let me just say that again. The cross will cut into our lives where it hurts, sparing neither us nor our carefully cultivated reputations. Dietrich Riskel tells of an experience that when a city was bombed in Germany by the Allies in 1944, and in that bombing, thousands of people were killed. And he tells a story that after the bombing, he was lying outside this disused, destroyed railroad station, looking at fires burning all over the city. And he caught a glimpse of a little inscription above the railroad station that said this: "Beyond the stars, there must dwell a gracious Father." He said this: "I don't want to know such a God. I want to know a God that bled. I want to know a God that experienced pain. I want to know a God that experienced all the daily difficult irritations of daily life." And it's interesting, it's only us moderns ask the question, does God care? The disciples, I mean, read through the New Testament. Never once in the New Testament is the question asked of Jesus, do you care? Why? Because visibly every single day when Jesus came across a person, a leper, the Samaritan woman, a person who had died, they knew by the visible expression on his face. Yes, he does care, because care engaged them into action. So it's left to us moderns to ask that question. Does God really care? But Jesus' action was always moving forward. So I want a God who understands my pain, who understands my suffering. Joyce and I are creatures of habit. We ritually back home, go to the gym most mornings. And I'm really anti-social at the gym. The last thing I want to get engaged is with some halfwit who's going to tell me about their sexy body, their new tan, and their new car. But if someone says to me, Gary, I have struggled with suffering, I have struggled with pain, and hear their lessons, I will turn my ear to listen. So I think life is not learned from sexy tans, fancy cars, and well-shaped figures at the gym. I think life is learned in the Dachas, the townships, the Auschwitz of this world. And when people tell me they have suffered, I really do. I incline my ear to hear their story. So let me just ask another question. How can I be different? I often do this quiz, and we'll see if you get this right. Okay, there was a song in the 60s called "When This Old World Starts Getting Me Down, I Know a Place That's Trouble-Proof Up on the Roof." Okay, first question, who was the first group to sing that? The Drifters, you're right, okay. Who else in the early 70s? James Taylor and Carol Keane, who was born Carol Klein, is a Jew in Brooklyn in New York City. But I think it's a great song for Christians. I think it just sums up our Christian subculture. So here's how it goes. I'm not singing it. When this old world starts getting me down, I know a place that's trouble-proof up on the roof. If you want to ask me today where the church has been for a lot of the 20th and 21st century, it's up on the roof. Waiting there primarily for Jesus to come in his holy helicopter and remove us from the mess and the chaos of the street. So that's why churches have this fortress door mentality. It really is a fitting song for our born-again culture, which has become no more than a way out of the chaos as a mess. As a church society, our new residence is up on the roof, away from the mess, the filth, the chaos of the streets below. So I want to suggest that we need to get back to the street, because that is where we belong. Why are we like that? Because I think the church in the West does not see salvation as a life. We have made salvation just forgiveness, not a lifestyle. You remember George Bush, you remember his phrase, the New World Order. Ask me, what do you mean? Define that. Because the world has always been a chaotic, messy place. I mean, the United Nations will tell you in the 80% of their budget today goes on man-made war. Because primarily it is men. It has increased 60% in the last 10 years. There are 50 unstable states in the world today. Half of them are on or almost on the borders of Europe. So it is a world filled with war and pain and disease and terrorism and hunger. It's not unlike the world that Jesus came to. But instead of going into the world as Jesus recommends, we've created our own world within a world. It's a world where Christian things are true, where everyone lives happily ever after, and more importantly, we can be safe from the other world, the big scurry world culture over there. And that safety and security we count on so much in our own little world has less to do with Jesus Christ than with locks, fences, money, and most importantly of all, the right neighborhood. And it's important to know that we've created a subculture within a culture. We've done exactly what Jesus told us not to do. We've put our light under a bushel of safe Christian subculture. I must confess I smile somewhat cynically, and I'm not a very cynical person, when people tell me they're trying to find themselves. I go, my God, that's exactly what Jesus told you you had to lose. Strange that, isn't it? I mean, that's kind of Oprah Winfrey. That's not Jesus. Like Oprah Winfrey, I just want you people to find yourselves. Really? Well, Jesus tells me I need to lose myself. So how that kind of pop psychology spills into the church. So the cult of the individual is basically the religion of the land. The quest for personal happiness exceeds our understanding of the truth. We really ask the questions, who am I? Where am I going? Is this all there is to life? So I want to introduce you to a philosopher who's had a profound effect on my life. It's 1926. He's sitting in a log. And he hears this buzzing sound, and the philosopher reasons along these lines. If there is a buzzing sound, someone is making a buzzing sound, and the only reason they are making a buzzing noise is because you are a bee. And then the philosopher thinks a long time, and he says, the only reason I know if you are a bee is you are making honey. And then he gets up and he says, and the only reason you are making honey is so I can eat it. His name is Winnie the Pooh. So even though this philosopher is called Winnie the Pooh, his work is mostly appreciated by children. I want to reflect seriously on this philosopher's life. Because the incident primarily shows Pooh to be what I would call a pragmatic individualist. He cannot imagine the bees possessing an existence or a purpose apart from his own use or interest. So the Pooh is the consumer, the kind of entirely practical and entirely self-centered. So the only reason for being a bee is to make honey. And the only reason for making honey is so I can eat it. Thus reasoning, the Pooh has a range of other possibilities completely blocked from his vision. He cannot see, for instance, the wider ecological purpose of bees, how they weave into a fabric of flora and fauna, not only providing honey, but also other such crafts as pollinating flowers. Another thing Pooh cannot see is the theological purpose for bees. The wonder of their existence. They speak, they spell out the glory of a creator God. So Pooh is, in short, a bear of very little vision. And that's what's part, I guess, what makes those kind of ingenious stories so amusing. But you know, brothers and sisters, what is not so amusing? Is it our language for God and life, our serious Christian adult language, is every bit as restrictive as the Pooh's playful, religious, childlike language. And I feel to speak like Pooh disposes me to think first and often only of myself and my benefits. But the sad thing is, at its extreme, it reduces life simply to a contest of self-interest. For me to gain, someone else must lose. So why do we not ask those questions? Who am I? What am I doing here? Is this all there is to life? T.S. Eliot writes this piece of verse called An Epitaph for a Godless Person. He says this: a cry from the north, from the west, from the south, whence thousands travel to the time-kept city, where my word is unspoken, in the land of lobelias and tennis flannel, the rabbit shall burrow and the thorn revisit, the nettle shall flourish in the gravel court, and the wind shall say they were decent, godless people. Their only monument, the asphalt road, and 1,000 lost golf balls. So an epitaph for a godless people who had all the answers but never worked out the questions, who had shunned real happiness in pursuit of a dream. What dream? A dream when they awoke from and landed in the reality the dream was death. They die and their philosophical dream dies with them. But I think into that world that we inhabit of the 21st century, Dorothy Sayers, I quoted a little bit from her last night. Let me read this slowly. It's one of those, I'm a bit of a buff for long quotations, as Joyce knows. My iPhone is packed with quotations. But here she says this: the people who hang Christ, to do them justice, never accused him of being a bore. On the contrary, they thought him too dynamic to be safe. It has been left for later generations to muffle up that shattering personality and surround him with an atmosphere of tedium. We have very efficiently parred the claws of the Lamb of Judah, certified him meek and mild, and recommended him as a fitting household pet for pale curates and pious old ladies. To those who knew him, however, he in no way suggested a milk and water person. They objected to him as a dangerous firebrand. True, Sayers says, he was tender to the unfortunate, patient with honest inquirers, and humble before heaven, but he insulted respectable clergymen by calling them hypocrites. He referred to Keenherd as that fox. He went to parties in disreputable company and was looked upon as a gluttonous man and a wine-bibber, a friend of publicans and sinners. He assaults indignant tradesmen, throws them and their belongings out of the temple. He drives a coach and horses through a number of sacrosanct and hoary regulations. He cures diseases by any means that come handy, with a shocking casualness in the matter of other people's pigs and property. He shows no proper deference for wealth or social position. When confronted with neat dialectical traps, he displays a paradoxical humor that affronts serious-minded people. And he retorts by asking disagreeable, searching questions that could not be answered by rule of thumb. He was emphatically not a dull man in his human lifetime. And if he was God, there can be nothing dull about God either. But then Sarah said he had a daily beauty in his life that made us ugly. And officialdom felt that the established order of things would be more secure without him. So they did away with God in the name of peace and quietness. And yet for most of us, if we are honest, that is not the kind of model of Jesus that we've encountered in our churches. He's safe. He's predictable. It's like the story I remember reading of a church that was being built, and the lead pastor was walking around with the architect, and they were discussing stained glass windows. And the lead pastor turns to the architect and says, "Do you think you could put a subtle cross in the window above the baptismal font?" The word "subtle" and "cross" is a kind of an enigma around that. But you know, keep the subtle Jesus and the subtle cross in stained glass windows. From sort of 1999 to kind of 2 or 3 years ago in my life, I spent at East Belfast Mission. Methodist missions within the British Isles, of all the sort of stuff that we normally do around church, but they have a very big social arm. And really, they were primarily a response, really, to social need during the Victorian era. There were a number of people in my sort of Wesleyan tradition were saying, it just isn't enough to do a worship service with all these major social needs, with people crowding from rural areas during the Industrial Revolution into the city and living in some incredibly impoverished situations. So in summer 99, to use our sort of Methodist phraseology, I was stationed or sent to East Belfast Mission with around sort of 20 staff then, sort of working in homelessness and also employability. And we just began to dream a dream, sort of post-conflict, of putting together this post-conflict urban village. And so over a 15-year period, it was finally opened in 2012. We opened a $30 million, ended up the largest faith-based project in Western Europe. Today in that village, there are 150 people working that site. There are 150 people live in that site. East Belfast Mission is still the main anchor tenant with about 100 staff. But we've partnered with other people. So, for example, there's a day centre for a mental health agency run by a secular organisation. There's a theatre company called Replay Theatre. There is a day centre for those who are frail elderly. There is a counselling clinic. So we tried to create this space within the inner city that while the church would still be the spiritual heartbeat, there was an engagement with the wider world. And so I think the question for us, as we try to redirect the church outwards, in the midst of all the despair, in the midst of all the questions, how do we do that? How do you do it? I mean, my analysis there last night when we talked about theology within the Wesleyan context. And if you were here last night, you heard that illustration. It's just like, you know, John Stott, the evangelical Anglican who died there a few years ago at the age of 92, says that, you know, theology is like a bird. We need personal holiness, which is important, but we also need social holiness. And you know as well as I do, if you lop off the wing of one of the birds, the bird will collapse. And that's why I think the church is so unbalanced today. Because primarily, I think, as Nadia said the other night, we are primarily, we're entertainment centers. I'm not against excellence, but we're so obsessed. And I've often asked myself the question, and I don't get this right. In fact, I get it wrong most of the time. But the amount of time that I spend watching movies or television during the week, which isn't a lot, but am I engaging with the outside world in relation to that time? The amount of time folk go to choir practice, maybe 2 hours a week. Are you engaging with the outside world? I'm just talking about a kind of question of balance. I mean, spilling back, and then we'll open it up for questions, that whole concept of the purpose of life, the meaning of life. Because in Ecclesiastes, which really is a lament for 21st century living, the questions are constantly asked. Where do I find my happiness? Let me just finish with a story that I used on the podcast there yesterday. It's a story by Albert Camus, the French existentialist. Paris was riddled with those guys, as you know, in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. But he tells a story about a man living in a village. His wife was a village girl. who had never been into the city. He was a businessman. And so on one occasion, he takes her reluctantly into the city. And he leaves her at this intersection in the city and says, you go, you look around, I will do my business, and I will come back and meet you. We will go to a hotel, we will have dinner, we will spend the night there, and we will go home. She doesn't want to be left alone. She's a girl from a village. But he must go, so he leaves her, standing at the intersection, and she is tempted by a temptation that she had as a youngster, looking at all these people in the busy intersection of the city. Camus the atheist does not tell us what the temptation is, except he says it was a lustful dream. And finally, she's struggling. And in this room, even though we don't want to confess it, we've all experienced sexual temptation. So visualize this. She's saying, should I do it? Should I not do it? If I do it and my husband finds out, there will be violence. But if I do it and I don't get caught, it will be great. I have longed for this for so long. So she takes too long to decide. Her husband comes back. They go to the hotel. They have dinner. They get into bed. He immediately falls asleep after the busyness of the day's business transactions. But she is lying with her head on the pillow, saying, I may never have this opportunity again. So she slips out. She gets changed. She goes out, and in the words of Albert Camus, she enjoys the lusts of the night. She comes back. She slips into the bed, changes her night clothes. But now the head she puts in the pillow is a completely different mind as she stirs into the blackness of the ceiling. The previous hour is replaying in her mind. Gradually the tears come in. They begin initially running down her face, and then they're pouring so profusely, and she sits up straight in the bed. She begins to sob uncontrollably, and as she sits up, her husband awakes, listening to the sobs, and asks her the question, what is the matter? And in typical, atheistic, existentialistic anticlimax, she says these words, and the book ends with these words. She says, nothing, just nothing. And the loneliest moment, and us 21st century mortals need to hear this, the loneliest moment in life is when you have just experienced that which you thought would deliver the ultimate, and it lets you die. The loneliest moment in life is that when you've just experienced what you believe would deliver the ultimate, and it lets you die. And this gentleman last night, I mean, I thought of what you said, why people just don't get this Christian thing, why they don't engage. Because sometimes the way we live this out, the way we spill it out into wider society, it's really no different. We pursue the things that most people in modernity pursue. Those are the things that give us satisfaction. I'm not getting into the debate today of hell and literal hells, annihilation and universalism. But taking you back to another generation when most people did believe in a literal hell, William Booth, and I'll finish with this, who was the founder, as you all know, of the Salvation Army, he said this. He said, if I believed what you Christians believe, that people who die in their sins impenitent would burn in hell, I would crawl over broken glass in London day and night calling on them to repent. It's an old-fashioned kind of quotation. But you get the drift. I sometimes wonder, you know, do we really believe in life after death? I mean, if this stuff isn't really true, or is there a bit of kind of sort of Hans Gretel, a little bit of fairy tale and all this kind of Christian stuff? Because going back to William Booth, if I believed Would you Christians really believe that people who die in their sins will burn in hell for all eternity? I would crawl over broken glass in London day and night, pleading with people to repent. When William Booth heard that saying, that's what motivated him to actually start the Salvation Army. So that analysis, old-fashioned and Victorian as it may well be, maybe a bit insulting to us modern, sophisticated mortals in a sense, but it was that that drove him to realize that church needs, that faith needs to be much more engaging, much more active. So we'll pause, take a few questions, and see where we go from there. I meant to throw up some pictures of Skeynos, so I will maybe attempt to do that. My passion, I forgot about it, but that's nothing new. Now, what do I have to do now? Oh, here? All right, okay. So someone make a comment while I'm trying to be semi-technological, which I am not.
But my Greek is very old and okay. Out of date.
Okay.
The word Skeynos looks Greek. What
yeah, it's 10th. It's the Greek. It's in John 1 and verse 14. No, well, there's nothing there, so we need to send for Chris. Or if there's anyone else. Maybe it's searching again. So yeah, oh, here we are. Did come up. Okay, so, and Jesus moved into our neighborhood and Skeynos among us and pitched his tent among us. So, I mean, there's actually three meanings to it. So the first meaning in the sort of Greek version of the Hebrew Bible, it talks about God's presence in the tent of meeting. So we wanted to create a space where we believe God's presence was, but we wanted it to be incarnational as well, to say that in this neighborhood, and calling a $30 million building a tent was pretty understatement. So we wanted people to resist the temptation to fall in love with buildings. We also decided we didn't want to call it after a dead Methodist either. So, you know, which people often do, you know, the so-and-so hall, etc., etc. So we decided no. And Paul also uses it, and my Greek is long gone, Heidi, like from the mid-80s, long gone. And Paul also uses it to describe sort of frail earthen vessels. In fact, Philip Yancey, commenting on that passage, talks of Paul was writing that today, the way he talks about like we're worthless like earthen vessels. He said if he was writing that today, he would probably use the phrase like cardboard boxes. So that many people, we were just throwaway in the eyes of the world. So it was. So I'll just run through these pictures if I can. So the tiny little thing there at the top, the little boat, they're scattered all throughout the building with dates on them. So the theology is very understated in the building. And the nose bolts, the idea is to say behind this quite sophisticated $30 million building, it's like held up by a series of bolts. You know, this kind of quite mega structure. So this is kind of one in the middle, okay, at the bottom there. So I'll just tell you a humorous story. So this is a kind of garden, sort of vertical garden. Okay, so here's how complex Irish society is, okay? So we have a firm, a Dutch horticultural firm, putting this together, okay? And we tell them there are certain flowers you can't use. So these Dutch people are going, you what? Say, no, flowers here can be sectarian. So this really, these guys go, are you being serious? They say, no, we are. So you're not allowed to use, you know the flower, the orange lily? That is a Protestant flower. Attached to drums and banners on the 12th of July. Why? Because William, Prince of Orange, in 1690 defeated the Catholic King James. White lilies, also out of bounds, they're Catholic. Because to celebrate the Easter Rising, Republicans, members of the IRA, wore a white lily on their breast. We have another flower that's called, again, after King William, called Prince William. That was also out of bounds. So we ended up simply putting together a field that we said would look like a field in County Down, which is a county in Northern Ireland. Now, the interesting thing in that, C.S. Lewis, who, as you know, spent most of his life there at Cambridge and Oxford, when he was asked, what did heaven look like? This was long after this came into my head. He says, heaven would be Oxford placed in the middle of County Down. It was a very sort of typical kind of C.S. Lewis quote. So the whole idea then was to create this kind of square. And you see there on the left-hand side, these are very, very small, so apologies for that. So the whole idea was a shared space. So we've created this very massive square. Now, interestingly, when we were putting this together, several business people said to me, you know, Gary, you're getting this completely wrong. I said, why? You have all that space. You're creating this space where you could be packing in, you know, small startups and making a lot more money. But we really theologically took the decision in the inner city where people don't have parks or space or green day to create this sizable square where people can actually come to. You know, so in that, I mean, Joyce, my wife, would have this kind of sort of Skenos festival every year as well. So it was trying to create a kind of alternative space. This is a picture of the square. And there, Janelle, on the right-hand side, is a little bit of Chuck and Peg's artwork, which I know you are aware of. So that's how Joyce and I actually got to know Chuck and Peg. They were members of a church in Florida, quite a sizable Methodist church in Florida, who ended up coming to Belfast in maybe 2001, 2002, and did a lot of artwork. So that's some of their artwork tucked up on the right-hand side. But this was also a social enterprise. So just to give you an insight to that, and then we'll open it up to questions. 2006, we had a pretty crummy sort of secondhand clothes shop and a secondhand furniture shop with all the kind of smells that those sort of secondhand clothes shop have. And we got a grant of £500,000, $750,000 from the Community Waste Initiative Fund. And we brought in someone and we developed this social economy, but we developed it in an environmental context. So most people, when they get new furniture, invariably and sadly, their furniture ends up in landfill. So we put 3 to 4 vans on the road in the greater Belfast area and encouraged people, donate this to a charity. So inside a 5-year period, we ended up with this project, having 10 shops in the greater Belfast area, employing 30 to 40 people and making $3 to $4 million a year out of a social enterprise, social economy. So as well as that money going back into some of the projects, we were also doing this environmentally. And so for example, every bicycle that is dumped in the city dump in Belfast now comes to the Skenos project. And it's kind of, so everything's a re, you know, so the cafe is refreshed, the furniture is restored. The bicycle, not very creative, is recycle. So it recycles the cycles, in a sense. And then we have the thing repaint. It's something like me didn't know. Apparently, after most people paint their houses, they just dump their paint cans in the bin. And then they end up in landfill. So now, a sizable amount of those that are dumped, they end up coming to us. And like I'm not very technical, but the paint is mixed and remixed and many other colours. But you think, like, 10 years ago, that project was making $150,000. Today it's making between $3 to $4 million per year. And the engagement again with the wider society is pretty phenomenal. So let me flip up the last slide, which I may have already done, and then we can open up for questions. Yeah, that's the place lit up at night. And I mean, those are very small, but these are lights, but they're not lights. They're actually tent poles. So the imagery is very hidden in a sense. So it's not in most churches, you know, when you go in, Christian iconography, you just can't miss it in a sense. There's a subtleness, so you need to think about it, you need to learn about it. And for example, and this is practically impossible to see, the Titanic was built in Belfast. Most people know that, and the saying, it's up there, okay. Okay, this is my brother-in-law who's in Lisbon with my sister, so Lisbon's hot and they're enjoying it. Could have been more passionate in that message a bit further down, so glad we just saw the top. so So the joke in Belfast as regards to the Titanic always is, it was okay when it left here. So I say, it was a cursed North American iceberg that did the damage. Nothing to do with us at all. It was those Americans once again. So, this, but in the, this here, if you were to look closely, some of these seats are actually shaped like the bow of a ship. So we tried very much, because the big industries in Belfast, in the kind of sort of Victorian era, Belfast is one of the richest cities in Europe, really was shipbuilding, the linen industry, and also the rope works and heavy engineering. So we've tried to tell that history also throughout the building. So within the church building, some of the windows have ropes on them, where people, you know, would have gone to factories there in another generation. The stairs that take you up look like the side of a ship, so it's like the bit sort of, so the stairs are very heavy sort of metal. If you bang it, almost like resounding the side of the ship. So we really try to not have it dominated by Christian iconography, but telling the history of an area that has really become very, very deprived. So I guess, I suppose, up in the sort of Pittsburgh, which you sort of call the Rust Belt, how you would tell that history of another generation in your stories. And these people who are much more arty than I, which I'm terrible at, but the, like, you know, these folk here will be able to tease that out. So look, questions, and then we'll go for lunch. That was a long, rambling lecture, but. So any comments or thoughts? So we've covered a lot there, obviously, you know, starting role of the church, how do we engage, bit of kind of philosophy around what brings satisfaction in the 21st century, and then looking at the whole kind of engagement through Skenos with the outside world. Yeah, go ahead.
I have a question almost. This is a little bit left over from your talking about the Good Friday agreement.
Okay.
How much of that was just appealing to, we need peace, we don't want to keep killing each other, and how much actually involved religious or Christian terminology or themes? Was that a part of it at all?
Okay.
Or was it just this other, you know, peace, no killing?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Good Friday Agreement, as I've often said, was a masterpiece in political compromise. So there's no way you could say it was a religious document. I mean, the irony is, you know, again, that's what you haven't said. Interestingly, the Good Friday Agreement, although it's got that name, Protestants call it the Belfast Agreement, although I don't, you know, so we still even can't agree on the title, but that's nothing new in an Irish context. I think it's fair to say there that quite a number of religious leaders fed into those who did the negotiations. So those in the background would have been saying to people that a deal needs to be done, we can't keep killing each other, we need to find a new beginning, but it was not a religious document, there's no question about that. But it is fair to say that, you know, in any stage when senior politicians are coming in from the States or anywhere else, there was always a religious input. So I think I mentioned about you know, Gary Hart there, who was the former presidential candidate, you folk know better than I do, was because of having a blonde and his knee in a yacht, things did not work out too well, but such is life. But the thing I didn't know, you know, I mean, at dinner with him one night, he actually did theology at Yale in the early 60s. And he still had a passion for that, you know, and a love for it, even though, you know, life may have taken a different turn. And then John Kerry sort of appointed him as a sort of US envoy there for a number of years. So in a sense, what does faith look like in the public space? You know, it's not because I'm like anything amazing or wonderful that I meet these people. I think the church has said back home, and maybe it was the bombings, the brutality, the killings that drove some of us to say, see, if we don't engage here, there's going to be a bloodbath for decades, if not centuries. You know, so it is like, as I said, desperate needs need desperate remedies. So maybe in the US context, again, just a suggestion, what is it going to take for the church to get off its ass and really engage? You know, what does that look like? I mean, are you going to wait until, I mean, I was chatting to someone the other day that maybe blacks and whites are killing each other in the street. Then we say, we need to engage now. So, because you can't, you know, the future is really unpredictable. You know, we kind of have this trajectory on the assumption things will more than likely go like that, but many times they don't. And So all I would say to the church is to have some kind of prophetic foresight or insight. And if there's a possibility of that happening, what are people of faith doing in the intervening period? Rather than wake up some morning and go, where did that come from? Really knowing it was there all the time. Because, I mean, that has really what happened to us. I mean, it was always a tinderbox. It was an IRA campaign in the 50s, border campaign. Didn't work out that well. But in the mid-60s there, you could see the thing bubbling, bubbling, bubbling. By 69, you know, once violence starts, it's much more difficult to bring to an end. It really, really is. And that would be a lesson I would say from America. Learn from us. Because once our campaigns broke out, it took us like 30 years in a small community to bring this to an end. So is the risk better taking now than in 10 or 15 years' time? Sorry, this lady here.
I don't know how to word this, but as you said, a small community.
Yeah.
And Belfast was really one of the primary centers of all the violence. We're from Oregon.
Yeah.
Oregon seems like a really peaceful place, and we don't go outside expecting a bomb.
Yeah.
But our hate crimes have just risen enormously.
Yeah.
And then looking at the wider country, I guess I'm wondering, what differences do you see from, you know, dealing with a city that is just like the center of all this? Mm. And looking at it from this huge country perspective.
Mm.
And were there areas in Northern Ireland that were not affected in the same way?
Yeah. By and large, most of the place was affected. So, I mean, if I just assume this is the square is Northern Ireland, sort of Belfast is tucked over here, Derry, Londonderry was up here, South Armagh was here. East Tyrone was sitting over here. So it was rural as well as urban. The difficulty with the urban context is people were living so close together. So, I mean, literally in that Four Spring project, I mean, I could walk from that door. So, I mean, like literally just to illustrate that. So, I mean, I would walk from here. So I'm still Catholic, still Catholic, still Catholic, still Catholic, still Catholic, still Catholic. Stop. Massive Berlin-type wall. Small pedestrian gate, through here, Protestant, Protestant. So really in the urban context, very, very close. Middle class areas, there weren't as many casualties, but there were a number. So judges, police, who primarily were living in middle class areas, were also targets. And within that, my sound is going on, so I'll just shout. So within that sort of urban context, there were lots of killings. But rural-wise, there were also lots of killings there as well. I mean, South Armagh was a really messy place. The border in Fermanagh, where Joyce and I are doing a number of work with people there who literally were ethnically cleansed, and I told some of those stories the other day, along the border. And, there's photographs you would see of a man on a tractor sort of ploughing his fields and his wife standing with a kind of legally held firearm protecting her husband while he's ploughing a field. So those images don't go away overnight. They just don't, especially when you're dealing with this generational historical pain that's passed from generation to generation to generation. So it's, this gentleman here.
Okay, I'm probably going to be in trouble for saying this.
No, go ahead.
So if I look, I'm 62 years old and I'm probably average in this room or something. But if I look at the long-term history of the world and the long-term history of the United States and, racial injustice, and I think of all, in my mind, we're in a great time of world peace. If you look, because the internet makes things so happy. You see something that happens in Oregon, and immediately the whole world knows that there is a racial problem in Oregon. And so if we look at, World War, we haven't had the Civil War in the United States. It killed millions and millions of people. The World War I, World War II, my generation with Vietnam, I knew high school kids that came back maimed and people who died and they didn't come back. And yet, the last 30 or 40 years, we haven't seen that kind of massive killing in the world. I know there's lots of problems that go out there. If we look at when I was a kid compared to now in terms of racial problems in the United States, great progress is made. I mean, I can remember Martin Luther King, and I remember the day that John F. Kennedy died, and I, you know, and many of us in here do. And so to me, you know, while we can say the church hasn't done anything, or the people haven't done anything, I think there's, if we look at clean water, there's, even in the last 10 years, more people have clean water in the world, less people have dirty water in the world by half, right? The malaria initiative has gone a long way. There's all these things that are very, very positive that have happened, and progress has been made. And the reason why I say this is, when listening to your talk, which I think is fabulous, I love what you're doing, and the peace negotiation, but I think we have made a huge amount of progress, and I don't know that, I mean, we don't have to go into politics, but I know how crazy that is, but things are in a pretty decent place compared to 100 years ago. Or 50 years ago. When you say we have a call to action for the church, which I think is absolutely needed, by the way, I don't know that the rest of the world believes that. The kids who my children and their children, which I have now, they live in this everything's fine world. And, you know, I just got back from El Salvador and everything's not fine there, and I understand that. But I think we're in a better place than we were 20, 50, 100 years ago. And I think when we say we have a call to action, I think some people are going to react and say, what do you need a call to action for? Why do I need a call to action? And I heard, Nadia, I heard you, and I think the church is way too lackadaisical. I mean, they're very self-centered, very, looking at themselves, and these Lutheran churches that think that they're Lutheran clubs or Scandinavian clubs rather than, spiritual beacons to the community. But I think there have been a lot of spiritual beacons to the community. And I think some of the people who've set up the foundations for the malaria initiative or whatever have done really great stuff and continue to do that. And I only say this because, it's easy for me to be depressed listening to you sometimes and say, oh, the fighting and they can't. And I was just in El Salvador where there's gangs and there's military and oh, my goodness. So I'm wrestling with my own emotions a little bit of saying how horrible everything is. And yet I know there's been a lot of progress. And I think the churches, or at least I say the church, the people in the churches have done a lot, and I know a lot of people in this room maybe have done a lot.
But I will say initially, every single thing you have said is true. Mm-hmm. So there's absolutely no question about that, okay? Roy Hattersley, who none of you probably know, but is a Labour peer in the House of Lords, in the Times or the Guardians, 5 years ago was an atheist, wrote, I'm not a Christian, but I'm glad the Christian church exists, because without the Christian church in Africa, we would be in a hell of a state. Mm-hmm. So everything you said in that context is true. But there's always the however comma. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Which is.
Yeah.
Okay. So let me just personalize this. So something happens to some of our four children when I'm away over racism or whatever, that puts a different twist. Something happens to some of your family through racism, it puts a different twist. Mm-hmm. So it does. I mean, so everything in that global sense of what you've said is just true, apart from the fact we do have the weaponry now to completely take each other out. There's absolutely no question about that. I mean, as regards ISIL, the Brookings briefing was saying ISIL were primarily a rural movement. Who became an urban movement. And there's no doubt that being the Iraqi army, with the resources they have with the Kurds, they probably over the next 6 months will decimate them completely. But they're going to disengage back to being a rural movement and probably becoming more terrorist networks. So there will be more Parises, more Berlins, more Madrids, more Londons. That probably is going to happen. There's no question about that. I suppose I would want to say, if that is going to happen, how do we as a church respond within the United States if there is the possibility of some serious antagonism between blacks and whites that may result in violence? All I'm trying to say is, prophetically, we sort of missed it in a sense. You know, that in the 50s and 60s, maybe, just maybe, with better leadership, I wouldn't have lost friends and family. So it's that kind of context. So it really is, as Natalia was saying there last night, it's not either or, it's both and. Mm-hmm. If there is the possibility, mm-hmm. does the church need to actually engage more in relation to that?
Yes.
And I think be more involved in the public space. I just think that's so important to me. Last July, Joyce and I were in Berlin, and I was speaking at this thing. It was a German sort of government put it together. It was the Organization, all these long titles, for Security and Cooperation in Europe. So like they asked me as a religious leader to come and talk about inside mediation with people who were pursuing terrorism, you know, because the EU want to do more work around that. You know, when I go back to Belfast, we have a number of sort of Iraqi governmental officials coming in, because they're left with the whole question now. You have this massive amount of people from the States, Britain, Belgium, France, Islamic jihadists pouring into Syria, wanting this dream of setting up a 7th century caliphate. Didn't work. Now, some of them may still want an obscure way to pursue that, but you're going to have thousands of, primarily men, are going to go what went wrong, who have been radicalized, and people are asking the question, how can we begin to de-radicalize some of these people? So some Iraqi government officials are going to spend time with some of us in Belfast looking at, you know, when our conflict was over, these people who were radicalized by Republican or loyalist ideologies, how did you begin to wind this down? So I mean, and exactly everything you said, through, there's no question about that. But the United Nations statistic that I quoted at the beginning, in the last 10 years, their budgets have increased by 60%. 80% of their budget is spent on man-made conflict. There are now 50 unstable states in the world. Half of them are on the borders of Europe. You know, so while as I look over the next 10 years with the refugee crisis, more folks spilling into, you know, Italy, Scandinavian countries, etc., etc., where is that all going to lead? I mean, I actually don't know. But I think the church needs to be influencing people rather than just leaving the politicians. So, I mean, whatever you said, true, major advances, water, malaria, etc., 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 but it's still a pretty chaotic place out there. And I guess if one of my family members dies today and I realise, if only I had done this. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about this theoretically rather than personally. So there's lots of hands going up there. Go ahead. So Dawn, go ahead. Thanks for being here.
I think we are in a bit of a lull before a storm that potentially could happen, may not happen. But since Obama was elected, we've had huge numbers of people become extremely well-armed across the nation. And you know, what's it take to set them off? And then we could have civil war very, very quickly if that happened.
Yes.
So, you know, I think that the message needs to be to engage, as you're saying, to get them to see things in a little different way and see, we see their problem and they see ours. But to me, as much as racial disparity, economic disparity that we are generating, and, you know, the rich are richer and the poor are poorer, and people recognize that and they want to change, and you know, so far we've worked at it more or less peacefully. I think there's a real risk that it may not continue that way unless we are engaged.
I think, you know, the baggy and that sort of personal pain. I mean, I have a friend, a boyhood friend, and Joyce knows well, and you know, he's my age, he's a man in his 50s, and he's involved in a lot of murders during our conflict. And he said to me, you know, Gary, this is my schoolboy friend. We used to walk to school together as kids. I ended up ministering, he's a terrorist. And he says, Gary, I go to sleep at night with the faces of the dead on my ceiling. He's on the highest dose of antidepressants a human being can take. And I've often told that story and say, at night, you know, if I'm not too tired, Joyce and I do a prayer together, I turn on my light and I go to sleep. This guy goes to sleep with the faces of the dead on the ceiling. Yeah. Now, could that have been different? Maybe, maybe not. But if it could have been, could I have maybe done more to say to him, you know, don't make that choice. So if I'm not speaking into his life, if the church is not speaking into his life, who is? And if we're not out there in the chaos and mess of life, as I said earlier, Jesus has said, if you rub salt into the carcass of a putrefying society, it's going to change. It's not going to change if we're doing like born again aerobics and born again Bible studies and all the sorts of stuff that we do. We've got to be out more rather than in more. So how do we create that model of church? Sorry, this is the beginning of something.
Yeah, I was just thinking overall, like I think you said, overall, what you said is true about many things in the world being much better, but I know there are people living in, you know, ghettos in Chicago, West Side, different places, and other places, not necessarily ghettos, you know, minorities and different things where they're, you know, they're seeing people, family members die daily through gang violence and stuff like that. And for them, it doesn't matter about malaria or clean water or other people, you know, like us middle-class white people, things are so much better. They don't know any of that. I mean, their lives are still just as hellish as, you know, as probably during in Belfast during the Troubles, you know, where they have people dying every day. You know.
I mean, even looking, you know, today, I mean, that sort of thing popped up from my brother-in-law Ian there. You know, I was doing some emails there this morning and got a beep, you know, there were three Palestinians shot dead in Jerusalem today. So, I mean, that some people are saying is this because of the whole Dome of the Rock, Temple Mount, El Askamos, is there the possibility of third intifada? I think we have friends in Ramallah who are Muslims and Christians, who are friends in Jerusalem. On both sides of the fence there are friends in Tel Aviv, and you just know that erupts, you know, because that, I mean, that is the most contested piece of real estate in the world. So it's, you know, there's no question about that. So it's just how things become so unpredictable. I mean, the other thing, like, just really showing what you were saying there, it's interesting, in the early 1990s, the three sort of chaotic regions, like, headline-wise in the world, was the Irish conflict, South Africa, and the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And most people assumed in the Oslo Accords that the Israelis and the Palestinians were over the line, and it was us, crazy Irish, who were lagging behind, mm-hmm. and they were wrong. Mm-hmm. We got over the line before the Israelis and Palestinians, and also the South Africans, although economically, as I said, South Africa is still a basket case in a sense, and it has been bad government. You know, there's no doubt that government. So I have a photograph of myself and Jacob Zuma, who's now the president of South Africa, in 1991 with his six wives, but not the six wives were on the photograph, okay, just me and him. Okay. So, but I said to Joyce, I've never showed it to anybody. You know, I showed it to one of Clinton McQueen yesterday, isn't that nice? You know, you never put your photograph up with Jacob Zuma because he's an absolute thug. He's an extortioner, and you know, he's a polygamist. So you just wouldn't do it, in a sense. But the corruption there within South Africa there as well. So one final comment or question, and then we need to do it once. Okay, go ahead, Dale. We'll do two.
I think it's Shirley over there talking about that our well-publicized, most recent well-publicized hate crime in Portland is that as the church, we need not only to engage with our black community, but we also need to engage with our Muslim community and let them know that they are part of us. They are not something separate.
And I think it's happening, you know, okay, imagine, to be perfectly honest, you know, as a teenager growing up in Northern Ireland, thankfully I didn't make any bad choices. But I can go confess my sins. I hated Catholics and Republicans. Hated them. To the extent when they were killed, I was glad. As for Andreas was, I was glad. You know, I cheered. They cheered and we were killed. You know, so that's high intense. Thankfully, Jesus has softened my bigoted sectarian heart, in a sense. And I think for many folk, you know, looking at the kind of whole Islam thing, first of all, you know, we don't know a lot about it. I mean, Joyce and I have a friend who lives in East Jerusalem. He works with an Israeli guy who's a former lieutenant in the IDF on the Gaza border, and both Leo and Ihal put together this thing called Shields, which Joyce and I work extensively with. And you know, I can guarantee you, this guy is honest, faithful, genuine, like many folk from that constituency. But the problem is, we haven't had the encounter. We haven't humanized them. We haven't heard their story. And because of that, you know, we live behind our fortress doors in the church with all the scary stories. And it's high. Okay, so that's it. We have to take a couple more, but this lady and this gentleman, then we really need to go lunch.
I think in the United States we do a very good job of deflecting the issues that we have here and jump into another country to help. And I know when our daughter was serving in Palestine, in Palestine, in Ramallah, actually, with the Young Adults and Global Mission. Many people like Bishop Yunon and others said, you know, you really need to take a look at what's happening in your own country and try to help solve the big issues, because you're really good at deflecting to other countries and their issues. And so I think that, yeah, things might be getting better, but we continue to deflect the biggest issues that we have in the United States and not dive in to try to improve those. Yeah.
Go ahead. Well, and just the point that Christians do make a lot of noise, and they are involved, and they shape elections, and they determine who's going to be president, and so on and so forth, and we shouldn't ignore that. And so I think that there's a question. You mentioned Jim Lawless. There are prophetic voices. I don't know why they're drowned out. Or nobody knows Jim Lawless, probably outside the Christian circles. I don't know. But they sure know the other voices from the right. And there is a right and a left, in spite of what we might want there to be. And it matters. And so I guess for me, there's a question. At what point does the left get loud? Not necessarily shouting at people, but making their voice known, and maybe to other Christians, to say, that doesn't represent us. That's something different. This is what we stand for, and we want the world to know that. And the things that you can do to reach out and be your local community support, and be that voice that brings the community together and so forth, sometimes that's crucial, and that's all there is to do, but that's local. But there is a national scene in which Christianity is broadcast to people for something that maybe isn't what we want it to be.
It's a very valid point that, in a sense, I mean, we need to finish with this here. We did this thing, and I mentioned this the other day, where it was really trying to challenge people biblically. Because those who are on the extreme right will say, look, theologically, this is how it is. This is it, in a sense. So we put together a project of more sort of liberal evangelicals, I guess, because evangelicalism in Europe is a different thing in Europe. Your evangelicalism is more like fundamental than something else, as we sort of look at from sort of Europe. But we put this thing together called Evangelical Contribution in Northern Ireland. And it was all theologically based. So we kept away from politics. And we spoke, as you're trying to say, those of us who saw ourselves as evangelical left, like the Jim Wallaces, the Tony Capoles of this world, and trying to wrestle this out in a scriptural framework. And it was relatively successful. People who hadn't engaged with the other side were beginning to engage with the other side for the first time. But the key was, it was taking the risk. And what we did, and again, you need some form of mass mobilization. So the first document, For God and His Glory Alone, and these aren't big numbers in an American context, but 250 people across the island of Ireland put their name to it. Clergy, business people, sports figures, etc., etc. You know, so it gave it a bit of kudos. So it's really getting that stuff right into the kind of public space. I mean, I'm not sort of name dropping here, but Joyce and I were down in Orlando. I mean, I know nothing about basketball at all, but Grant Hill, you know Grant Hill, yeah. Well, we had dinner with him and his wife. He's keen as a well-known star who I'd never heard of before February. What? I'd never heard of him, you know. But his mommy and Hillary Clinton were close friends. And we had this conversation with them, and they're saying, you know, we're up for something like this. So that's just one example. I'm sure there's 101 other big black Grand Hills and white Grand Hills out there as well that would be part of this. But you need discipline, organization, strategy, mobilization. And if you're telling me that there's nobody in the center left with those skills, it's fundamentally wrong. There are people that are going to do that. But it's determination, stickability, a sheer dogmatism to get this thing through. And you know, it is doable. And honestly, it is doable. So it is. You know, put back the civil rights movement. It wasn't exactly billions of dollars poured into that, but there was a passion, a motivation, a determination, a biblical mandate to say, this needs to be done. And I guess the question is, can it be done again? I can't answer that. You folk need to answer that. At the end of it. But there are good people out there. I mean, like we're traveling, like I travel a bit in the States, probably 2 or 3 months a year. I hear these conversations. But it's just, you're starting to join up some of these dots. There's lots of thought, there's lots of process. So you need a few champions to harness your energy. How do you find comments? We're on the stop.
In Whatcom County and Skagit County, there are groups of more progressive Christian and other faith-based leaders who are gathering around the slogan, "Let love be our legacy." There's a gorgeous logo, and the idea is to get the word out there. The subtitle is, "We're all in this together," to be a more vocal presence of our faith in the community. And I would encourage folks to find out more about the Let Love Be Our Legacy.
So, look, I mean, I think they're trying to put an email list together at Poland just to explore possibilities. So I would just encourage you to do that. Some folk have asked about sort of more information website now, which is very embryonic, but there's just a little card here, sort of about some of the work we do. So if anyone wants to grab on these, because I don't want to carry them in my case. So if you go to Florida, Joyce will shop, the weight will go up, but I don't want to put up with these.